Hi, welcome to season 3 of the Pictures Out There podcast series. This is chat number 29. Staying true to your real and true self can be a challenge, but it's doable. Keeping a sense of humor in the most difficult circumstances helps. In this podcast, Lee and Dave visit about that. Then they take a look at some important trends in education. And now, here's Dave and Lee.
Well, thank you, Candy, very much for that kind introduction. This is Lee.
And this is Dave. I'm a little slow on the take there.
Well, whether you're right with us or just a couple of beats behind, we welcome you in to another episode of the Pictures Out There podcast series. Nice to have you with us. As always, we like to extend warm welcomes to our present-day listeners, our audiences years, decades, perhaps millennia from now.
Way out there.
Yeah. Our AI audience.
Hello, hello, hello.
Our future and probably present alien audience and our universal audience. We are glad to have all of you listening. Thanks again for joining us. We like to always set up context for our conversations by having you reflect on the two following questions. Those questions are, what are your ideals and what are your pictures?
And if I unintentionally offended any aliens with my bing, 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 I have no idea where that came from, and I do apologize. So anyway, moving along here, today we invite you to have a nice time of reflection as we go through our chat today. If our podcast today had a formal title, particularly the first half of it, it might be something like Staying True to Your Real and True Self. Mm-hmm. We have as thought starters quotes that we lots of times like to use. There's one from Carl Jung, "I am not what happened to me, I am what I choose to become."
Very
point of reflection there.
Yeah, very, very interesting. Well, here's another quote for reflection about staying true to our unique selves, exploring and then using our true and unique gifts and abilities and talents for the betterment of the world and for our own enjoyment and satisfaction. And doing that, regardless of the messages we might receive from other people. And this quote is from Albert Einstein. You may have heard of him.
Mm-hmm.
If you judge a fish on its ability to climb a tree, it will live its whole life believing that it is stupid.
That conjures up for me. Lots of times we have the, you're really good at such and such.
You're a natural at.
And sometimes that we all like getting praise, mm-hmm. and we like giving praise to people. It can be kind of a double-edged sword sometimes in terms of the unspoken piece being either keep doing that because you're good at it and we want to do things we're good at.
Right.
Or it can be, there's a lot of things you need to stay away from.
Yeah, right. It can be deliberately or unintentionally exclusionary, right?
Yeah.
I mean, people have told me my entire life, oh, you're so gifted with words. The implication being, don't look at numbers, fool. And by the way, that's pretty much true.
It certainly conjures up the conversation around multiple intelligences or all of these other types of gifts and abilities. Are they intelligences or not? And life is an exploring, right? It's exploring of ourselves, what we like, what we enjoy. Mm-hmm. As we're learning, we usually start out not being good
at something. Right.
And so we certainly want to go learn and explore everything we can be and get past that deal of, you know, whether or not you're good at something. So we would just say, you know, if a fish wants to try to climb a tree, go do it.
Yeah. And we should try to help that fish if we can.
And if Albert, as he's saying, would suggest, well, if you do that, people may think you're stupid. Well, so be it.
Yeah.
Go try to climb that tree. I think there may actually be some fish that can kind of climb plants and stuff, right? Am I thinking of that right?
I don't know.
I'm going to look that up after this podcast.
What is the study of fish? Is that ichthyology?
I don't know.
Okay, we don't even know what the study of fish is. All right.
Three of our most beautiful words, I don't know. So anyway, understanding who we are at our core, our real and true self, and who we ideally want to be is primarily up to each of us. Once we understand that, we can then share that with the world and do it with confidence.
Yeah, so while we each enjoy when we get a positive reaction from other people, as mm-hmm. we were just discussing, we should never let the world's reaction to us influence us to be anything other than our real and true self. As life goes on, we continue to grow and expand that sense of who we truly are, and then we should share that with the world. That cycle should continue throughout our time of life. Mm-hmm. And on the matter of understanding what our ideals are, as we talk a lot about in this podcast series, and staying real and true to those ideals, we have this quote from long ago by the biologist and anthropologist Thomas Huxley, who states, "It is not who is right, but what is right that is important."
I can't think of a quote that's a clearer statement about ideals.
Yes.
And living by ideals and understanding what is right,
mm-hmm.
what's your compass, and mm-hmm. then going by it. And my goodness, what an incredible sense of liberation and freedom and simplicity, it seems to me, like we get when we are clear on our ideals and then use them to act, speak, and choose in the course of our lives. And man, it feels good. And we would say that we should just believe in that ability to do that and also to change and to drive the changes that we want that will inevitably happen in our lives. C.S. Lewis has a great quote, "You can't go back and change the beginning, but you can start where you are and change the ending."
I've always loved that.
Yeah.
We have agency. We have power.
Exactly. So this is very similar to our out there model, right? You start from where you are right now. You create your desired pictures of the future. You get clarity about the ideals that will drive your actions, your words, and your choices. And you then start the journey toward your pictures, supported by your ideals and life tools, and go be your best real and true self.
And so I think we're suggesting here this requires some active courage, right?
Absolutely.
Because what if you want to try something new and you fail at it?
You want to be the fish that tries to climb
the tree. But yeah. In many instances, with not getting it right or our vision of what getting it right is,
right.
we feel embarrassed.
Yep.
And then that will probably diminish our will and desire to try the next thing that we don't know about.
Mm-hmm.
So there is really an act of courage that I think is implied in all of this. Well, let's turn our attention to humor for a moment, right? So humor, for which we have a picture and deep appreciation, it can obviously help us get through some of the most difficult, desperate situations in life, particularly when we are ensuring that we stay true to our real and very best selves. Humor and laughter can give us courage, help us get through our darkest days. We can each consider if we're smiling and laughing as much as we would like, and if more good and real humor is available for us to use. Now, let's stop and think about that for a moment. Have you ever conducted a humor assessment for yourself? That's probably kind of a sophisticated, complicated way of stating that. But every now and again saying, hey, have I laughed in the last 2 days?
Right.
Yeah.
So
has
important.
Anything just tickled my fancy in the last couple of days? No, I feel a little humor deficient.
Yeah.
Therefore, I'm going to go look for things that will make me laugh in the
Love
next
that
couple
idea.
Of days. Yeah.
Love it.
Russian dissident Alexei Navalny, who recently died in a Russian prison under suspicious circumstances and who was very likely murdered, he wrote a letter for his then new Arctic prison home. He appears to have stayed true to his real self to the end, even by maintaining a sense of humor and perspective in a very deadly situation. Here's an article from the New York Times about Navalny's letter titled, "In Letter Heavy with Irony, Navalny Describes Transfer to Arctic Prison."
And Lee and I are going to read this article, as you might imagine, with incredibly mixed emotions, with incredible admiration for his bravery and courage and conjuring up the ability to have some humor in the situation while obviously an ultimately deadly situation.
Mm-hmm.
We have mixed feelings the whole time we're reading this.
Mm-hmm.
The article says, "The comments from the Russian opposition leader were written with a heavy dose of humor and seemed intended to assuage concerns among allies after his three-week disappearance. Alexei Navalny, Russia's most prominent opposition leader, published a letter on Tuesday, at the time of the article, describing an arduous transfer to his new penal colony in the Arctic, the first time his supporters had heard from him in 3 weeks. Mr. Navalny's comments, posted on his social network accounts and written with a heavy dose of irony and humor, highlighted his good spirits and seemed intended to assuage concerns among allies who had grown anxious about his health and status since his sudden disappearance from the public eye on December 5th.
Mr. Navalny wrote, referring to the Russian version of Santa Claus, he said, "I am your new Father Frost. I have a sheepskin coat, a hat with ear flaps. I should get felt boots soon, and I've grown a beard during the 20-day transit." And he added, "The main thing is now I live above the Arctic Circle." Navalny, who is 47 years old at the time, is a longtime, was a longtime protagonist of President Vladimir Putin in Russia, and has been subject to increasingly harsh punishment over the past year of his incarceration. His transfer to one of Russia's highly security special regime penal colonies had been expected for several months when he had lost an appeal against the 19-year sentence he was serving. But his lawyers and allies were not notified in advance that he would be moved, raising fears and speculation about his health after his legal team was unable to contact him. His ability to pass a letter from a new prison suggested that Navalny would most likely remain a fixture in Russia's public life as that country nears another presidential election that Mr. Putin is poised to win amid little genuine competition.
Mr. Navalny has been in custody, the article continues, since his detention in January 2021 at a Moscow airport, where he had arrived after spending months in Germany recovering from poisoning by a nerve agent. Mr. Navalny and Western governments have accused the Kremlin of the poisoning, a charge that Russian officials have denied. A former site of a Gulag labor camp, Mr. Navalny's new snow-swept penal colony in the town of Karp is one of the most remote in Russia. Known as the Polar Wolf Colony, it is surrounded by tundra and polar mountains. Freezing dark winters give way to brisk summers with clouds of mosquitoes. Daylight is scarce, a fact he alluded to in his letter. Quote, "I don't say ho, 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 but I do say oh, oh, oh when I look out at the window," Mr. Navalny said, "where I can see it's night, then evening, then night again."
He said that he had not seen much of his new Arctic permafrost surroundings yet, but that he had noticed that prison guards there were different than their colleagues in central Russia. Wearing warm mittens and felt boots, they carried machine guns and were aided by, quote, "those very beautiful fluffy shepherd dogs," Navalny wrote. A video report from 2019 from the prison by a municipal-owned news agency said that it had featured a library with 8,000 books, a shop, a church, and a prisoner cook who just loves making big cakes. A trip to Karp from Moscow takes more than 40 hours on a train, which departs every other day. But Mr. Navalny described a more complicated 20-day journey through the Russian prison system. He went to Moscow from his penal colony in the nearby Vladimir region, and then through Kirov up north to Vorkuta before finally arriving in Karp on Saturday, according to his letter. Quote, "I did not expect anyone would find me here until mid-January. I was very surprised then when yesterday the cell's doors were opened with the words, 'There is a lawyer here for you.'"
And so ends the article. Staying true to your real and true self. As we know, Navalny has since and very recently suspiciously passed away. He was in his 40s and very likely murdered. How frustrating for his brutal, cruel, and horrible antagonists that his spirit, his sense of humor, and his soul could never be submerged. In fact, with every attempt to do so, Navalny would merely reaffirm the brightness of his spirit, the creativity of his sense of humor, and the beauty of his soul. In the true endgame that we all have, of living life to the fullest, loving to the fullest, and being our true and best self, Navalny is a true winner. Mm-hmm. Rudyard Kipling has a quote that we'll read here. "Beware of overconcern for money or position or glory," we might add power. "Someday you will meet a man who cares for none of these things. Then you will know how poor you are."
Well, let's transition to another quotation by famed American writer Jack Kerouac, who did most of his work in the middle of the 20th century. He once wrote in a beautiful letter to his first wife turned lifelong friend, "Practice kindness all day to everybody, and you will realize you're already in heaven now." And author Roald Dahl said, "I think probably kindness is my number one attribute in a human being. I'll put it before any of the other things like courage or bravery or generosity or anything else. Kindness, that simple word, it covers everything to my mind. If you're kind, that's it."
Okay, there you go. So hopefully as part of being our true self, we have an appreciation for lifelong learning and for education. If you can't tell, that was a little bit of a pivot that we're going to do here. We want to be transparent and authentic with our audience. We're doing a slight pivot here.
Live radio, folks.
That's right. That's right. So hopefully we discover our real and true self in the process of lifelong learning, including the critical education that can occur during our childhood. If that phase of education is not what it could be, then we are left to seek those learnings about ourselves and about humanity as adults, or to go through the rest of our life with something basic and important missing from our life experience. So we've created a picture for education that appears an ideal out there, ideals out there, and that Lee and I have talked about before. We do invite you to read our picture for education in the book or on one of our podcasts, but to also consider what yours would be. Our picture does seem like it has what we'll call a sequencing challenge, I guess I would say. Mm-hmm. It appears to be an extra challenge to get to our picture for education in our society until some other concepts and pictures have already taken hold. Concepts and pictures like equality for all, a love for lifelong learning, greater comfort with driving constant change and growth in our lives, and greater appreciation for the breadth of our human gifts and abilities. Once those concepts are more of a reality, it will be a lot easier to drive to our picture for education.
Yeah, absolutely. I like the way you characterize that as a sequencing challenge, right? Mm-hmm. We think some other fundamental concepts have to be in place in order for that picture to be fully realized. So what are some interesting things going on in education today? And how do those things relate to our picture and our ability to discover our real and true selves while learning about how best to act as a unique contributing member of the human community? Well, for one, we have homeschooling's rise from a fringe form of education to the fastest growing form of education. Here are some excerpts from an article that was published in the Washington Post about 6 months ago. Quote, "Homeschooling has become, by a wide margin, America's fastest growing form of education as families from upper Manhattan to eastern Kentucky embrace a largely unregulated practice once confined to an ideological fringe," a Washington Post analysis revealed. The analysis, based on data that the newspaper collected for thousands of school districts across the country, reveals that a dramatic rise in homeschooling at the onset of the pandemic has largely sustained itself through the 2022-2023 academic year, defying predictions that most families would return to schools that have dispensed with face mask mandates and other COVID-19 restrictions.
The article continues, "The growth demonstrates homeschooling's arrival as a mainstay of the American educational system, with its impact on society, on public schools, and above all, on hundreds of thousands of children now learning outside a conventional academic setting, only beginning to be felt. Homeschooling's surging popularity crosses every measurable line of politics, geography, and demographics. Despite claims that the homeschooling boom is a result of failing public schools, the Post found no correlation between school district quality, as measured by standardized test scores, and homeschooling growth. In fact, high-scoring districts had some of the biggest spikes in homeschooling early in the pandemic, though by the fall of 2022, increases were similar regardless of school performance."
The article continues, "It is a remarkable expansion for a form of instruction that 40 years ago was still considered illegal in much of the country. Many parents say home education empowers them to withdraw from schools that fail their children or fail to provide instruction that better reflects their personal values. But there is little to no regulation of homeschooling in much of the country, with no guarantees that kids are learning skills and subjects to prepare them for adulthood, or for that matter, learning anything at all. Homeschooled children have attended Ivy League schools, and they have won national spelling bees. They've also been the victims of child abuse and severe neglect. Some are taught using the classics of ancient Greece, and others are taught with Nazi propaganda. What all share is the near absolute control of their parents wield over the ideas that they encounter.
So, celebrated by home education advocates, the rise has also led critics of weak regulation to sound alarms. Homeschool kids don't have to submit to any form of testing for academic progress in most states, and even states that require assessments often offer loopholes, according to the Coalition for Responsible Home Education, which urges greater oversight. Many of America's new homeschool children have entered a world where no government official will ever check on what or how well they're being taught. Quote, policymakers should think, wow, that's a lot of kids, said Elizabeth Barthelet, an emeritus professor at Harvard Law School and child welfare advocate. She continues, we should worry about whether they're learning anything.
So what lies ahead for American homeschooling? It has dropped from its pandemic peak in most of the school districts for which data are available. Yet even in those places, it remains elevated well above pre-pandemic levels. And in many districts, it continues to increase. Another factor that could boost homeschooling's appeal. Vouchers that offer parents thousands of dollars per year for children outside the public school system. Such vouchers have recently been made available to home educators in states including Arizona, Arkansas, Utah, West Virginia, and New Hampshire, as well as Florida. And they're on the agenda for conservative education activists across the country. Thanks in part to such policies, homeschooling will increasingly compete for tax dollars with the public education system. It could also undermine the role that public schools have traditionally played in American life. Many homeschooling families say they have recreated these communal functions through co-ops or micro-schools or Facebook. But such groups often cluster by shared ideology. Home education's rise has coincided with the fracturing of a nation, unable to agree on the results of the last presidential election, or how to fight a pandemic that killed more than a million people.
So, future audience, as well as our present audience, but certainly the future audience, it's a mess right now. I think our point in reading this article is certainly to historically mark what is going on right now in this period, which is an important part of what Lee and I do,
yes,
particularly for our future audiences and our AI audiences, et cetera. But one of the things that we could get asked in response to this article is, well, so do you guys think that the answer is what public schools are doing today? We would go, no.
No.
And you would go, well, do you think the answer is doing
more homeschooling?
What's happening in homeschooling? No.
No.
We think the answer is our picture. You know, and we invite you to look at that. Our picture involves a consistent, common approach to education for children that everybody would have the right to, that would be a right. It would be much broader, much more comprehensive, much more focused on social skills, mm-hmm. a broader set of topics that people learn the basics on,
mm-hmm.
things like neuroscience, how our brains even work.
Yeah.
And so that's our response to all of these things that are going on, the difficulties that public schools are having, as well as this incredible range of things that people are doing with homeschooling that's completely inconsistent.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Well, here's another article, very interesting, about how the Department of Defense has great schools. This article is titled, Who Runs the Best U.S. Schools? It may be the Department of Defense, and it comes from December, and Sarah Mervish of the New York Times. Sarah, I hope I pronounced your name correctly. Quote, schools for children of military members achieve results rarely seen in public education, with about 66,000 students, more than the entire public school enrollment in Boston or Seattle. The Pentagon's schools for children of military members and civilian employees quietly achieve results most educators can only dream of. On the National Assessment of Educational Progress, a federal exam that's considered the gold standard for comparing states and large districts. The Defense Department's schools outscored every jurisdiction in math and reading last year and managed to avoid widespread losses caused by the pandemic. The Defense Department's schools had the highest outcomes in the country for Black and Hispanic students, whose eighth grade reading scores outpaced national averages of white students. Eighth graders whose parents only graduated from high school, which typically suggests lower family income on average, they performed as well in reading as students nationally whose parents were college graduates. The schools reopened relatively quickly during the pandemic, so these results were no fluke.
The article continues, while the achievement of U.S. students overall has stagnated, over the last decade, the military schools have made gains on the national test since 2013. And even as the country's lowest performing students and the bottom 25th percentile have slipped further behind, the Defense Department's lowest performing students have improved in fourth grade math and eighth grade reading. This is fascinating. If the Department of Defense schools were a state, said Martin West, an education professor at Harvard, who serves on the National Exams Governing Board, we would all be traveling there to figure out what's going on. The Defense Department school system includes about 50 U.S. schools and more than 100 schools internationally.
So I think the numbers there are kind of important. We're just not talking about a dozen schools here, which you could argue are easier to manage and make investment in. No, this is a large operation, and it's globally flung.
And compared to a Boston or Seattle, it's bigger.
Bigger.
Yeah.
So these schools are not free of problems. Despite their high performance, Black and Hispanic students, on average, still trail their white peers in these Defense Department schools, though the gap is smaller than in many states. The Pentagon also faced scrutiny for its handling of student misconduct at these schools, including reports of sexual assault. So, how does the military do it? In large part by operating a school system that's insulated from many of the problems plaguing American education. Defense Department schools are well-funded. They are socioeconomically and racially integrated.
Oh, say that one more time.
Yeah, they're socially and economically and racially integrated. Key point.
Okay.
And they have a centralized structure that is not subject to the whims of school boards or mayors. Non-politicized. There are about 50 U.S. schools for children who live in military bases and more than 100 internationally for students whose parents are stationed abroad. And these range from Belgium to Bahrain in the Middle East.
So the article continues, for starters, families have access to housing and health care through the military and at least one parent has a job. I'm stopping here in the middle of this. Some of this stuff is
basic.
It's basic. And as a society, why do we... The article continues. Teachers are also well paid. Supported by a Pentagon budget that allocates $3 billion to its schools each year, far more than comparably sized school districts. While much of the money goes toward the complicated logistics of operating schools internationally, the Defense Department estimates that it spends about $25,000 per student, on par with the highest spending states like New York, and far more than states like Arizona, where spending per student is about $10,000 a year. Competitive salaries, scale to education and experience levels, help retain teachers at a time when many are leaving the profession.
The Defense Department's schools have another key advantage. Families have housing, and they have access to health care through the military. These small details matter. A well-stocked supply closet means teachers don't have to pay out of their own pocket for paper, pencils, and other classroom necessities. Another advantage. Prudence Carter, who is a Brown University sociologist who studies educational inequality, said the Defense Department's results showed what could happen when all students are given the resources of a typical middle-class child. Resources like housing, healthcare, food, and quality teachers. Dr. Carter said, we aren't even talking about wealth, whether they go to fancy summer camps. We're talking about basic everyday things.
So today, Defense Department schools are 42% white, 24% Hispanic, 10% Black, 6% Asian, and 15% multiracial. The military isn't perfect, says Leslie Hinkson, a former Georgetown University sociologist. There is still racism in the military. But what is distinctive, she said, is this access to resources in a way that isn't racialized. Defense Department schools are not immune to other conflicts, as we've said, including charged debates about race, gender, and identity. But the schools are inherently less political. Big decisions come from headquarters and therefore less tumultuous.
In many ways, these schools look like traditional public schools. The goal is to raise the floor for all students, something that Jason Dougal, who is president of the National Center on Education and the Economy, he sees in top-performing countries like Finland and Singapore, those internationally who are renowned as best in education. American school districts have often an all-star team mentality, Mr. Dougal said, relying on exceptional teachers and exceptional principals to get results. But the most effective jurisdictions, he said, have a, quote, systemic way of improving everybody on the team.
The article ends, isn't this true in every group setting, every walk of life, every
yes.
business, every organization? And the notion that people can just be left behind, or some people can get fewer resources than others, and inevitably that ends up impacting the whole team, the whole organization.
Yeah.
And we just disregard that impact sometimes.
Yeah, and just think about a very, very promising, intelligent, bright, full of life child who may be starting their schooling in an urban district with very precious few resources.
Yeah.
If that child were placed in another system, they might flourish and become the next great whatever.
Right.
In the circumstances they're in, it still may happen. It does happen, but the odds are against them.
Yeah, so to kind of wrap some of this together, education and lifelong learning is obviously a huge passion for both of us. And if there's a vehicle to not just being your true and real self, but exploring that and finding out what that really is, that avenue is lifelong learning.
Yes.
And access to all.
And we talk about the word curiosity all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And to
yeah.
incorporate that. So we always like ending a podcast with some optimism, momentum, and gratitude. And we are optimistic about how educational structures in our society can positively evolve over time. Just look at our picture. Helping each child to fully discover their true and real self and to express it in concert with other humans with whom they interact with as adults. There's a wonderful quote from Malcolm X. He said, "Education is the passport to the future, for tomorrow belongs to those who prepare for it today."
Mm. So today, do we have a picture for education? Do we have a picture for what we truly need to learn to have great lives and a great world? Do we have a picture for every member of our society having humility and curiosity with the abilities to ask questions and listen and have the joyful experience of lifelong learning?
Today, do we have a picture for our children being kept safe and secure while they're learning? Today, do we have a picture for learning early in life about those things that make for a great society of unique individuals who do harm to no one, who are then free to explore their gifts and talents in a culture and community of their choosing?
Today, do we have a picture for learning and living commonly shared ideals? Do we have a picture for love, helping others? Every person is equal in worth and value, no matter what. Do we have a picture for unconditional love for all? Well, tomorrow, can the answer be yes to all of these questions? Our answer to that question is yes.
And in the future, we would say the answer must be yes. There is no long-term alternative in order for us to survive and thrive. And those of you listening in the future, our future AI audience, our future alien audience, you know that we in fact did that. We solved this, and we are now at a much better place. And so we believe with all of our heart and head that the answer in the future will be yes.
In closing our discussion today, we ask you, what are your ideals? What are your pictures? What are your actions to take? And what is your influence to use? We'll talk to you soon.
Take care.
Thanks for joining us today. As always, feel free to explore more about Pictures Out There at picturesoutthere.com and major social media sites. We hope you have the day of your dreams, the day of your pictures.